From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, in for Terry Gross.
When you live in Baltimore City, especially coming up in the crack era, people dying is not a strange thing. Witnessing murders is not a strange thing.
Today, author Dee Watkins describes coming of age during the crack and semi-automatic weapons era in East Baltimore.
Everybody's parents were junkies, and all the kids were selling.
Watkins started selling crack after his older brother, a drug dealer, was shot and killed. He'll tell us how he eventually quit selling drugs, earned 3 college degrees, and became a teacher. His new book is The Cook-Up, a crack rock memoir. Also, David Edelstein reviews the new Whit Stillman film, Love and Friendship, based on a posthumously published Jane Austen novella. And we remember poet Michael Harper and listen back to him reading his poem Dear John, Dear Coltrane. Harper died Saturday at the age of 78. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, sitting in for Terry Gross. Today's guest, Dee Watkins, describes himself as having beat the streets. He grew up during the crack and semi-automatic weapon era in East Baltimore, where the HBO series The Wire was set. He escaped getting killed several times, but his brother didn't. He was shot to death during the period he was selling crack. Dee Watkins managed to go to college after his brother's death, but soon dropped out and became a crack dealer himself. He gave up the business before it was too late, returned to college, and now has 3 degrees, including a master's in education from Johns Hopkins University and a master of fine arts in creative writing from the University of Baltimore, where he now teaches writing. He's been a columnist for the Baltimore Sun and for Salon, and published a collection of personal essays called The Beast Side, Living and Dying While Black in America. He's just written a new book called The Cook-Up, a crack rock memoir, about his life growing up on the streets of Baltimore. Terry Gross spoke with Dee Watkins last October when his collection of essays was published.
Dee Watkins, welcome to Fresh Air. You wrote a piece when you were 14. This was for a history class, a paper for a history class, and it was called My Baltimore, the 15 Times I Was Almost Murdered. So you were almost murdered 15 times by the time you were 14?
Yeah, and, you know, I wish I could go back and find that paper. I wish, because I would like to compare, like, the way I wrote back then to some of the things that I've been working on, you know, later, because I kind of feel like that same storytelling skill is still there. But yeah, not just me, and it probably was more than that amount of times. When you live in Baltimore City, especially coming up in the crack era, people dying is not a strange thing. So witnessing murders is not a strange thing. Or being in a situation where you're on a basketball court and somebody starts shooting is not a strange thing. Some people can say that, you know, they have almost been murdered 15 times in just a summer. I just wrote down a bunch of stories about things that I've saw and things that I've been through.
Tell us one of those stories.
So one of those stories was, I had a friend, a really, really close friend. He's passed away now, but he was being bullied. He was being, you know, he was being picked on. He got beat down like 3 times by the same group of guys. And these guys, they were notorious in East Baltimore. They used to roll around in packs of like 35 and 40. And I got beat up by them before. They used to beat us down. But, you know, my one particular friend, they beat him up like a couple of times, 3 or 4 times. And we're like 12 and 13 years old around this time. So, you know, we used to hang on this corner called Robinson Street. The corner of Robinson on Orleans Street. We was outside. It was some girls outside. It was some people outside. And, you know, it was a regular summer night. We were having a good time. These guys been in the corner, you know, and there's so many of them. You know, they spot them, and they walk up on them. And, you know, there was about 10 of us. So, you know, we swelled up and just stood up. You know, it's more of them than us, but whatever, let's do this. And out of nowhere, you know, none of us expected this. We didn't even know. He pulled a gun out, and he just started busting shots at the crowd. Like, when he was behind me when he did it, so I felt like bullets passed right past my head. And, you know, I hit the deck, and he ended up shooting his cousin in the hand by mistake. And those same guys, they didn't pick on him anymore. But that was almost like one of the worst situations for him, because after he did that, you know, it was no looking back. He carried that gun like, you know, like that was his best friend, and it ended up being the way he died.
Well, he was shot after?
Yeah, he was murdered. He was murdered a few years later after that.
So when you saw that happen, like he had a gun to shoot back at the guys who were beating him up, and then he had to really, really protect himself after that and ends up being shot anyways. What did you take away from that?
It's one of my best friends, so it hurt really bad. I didn't become an advocate against gun violence at a young age because it happened, but I understood him. You know, I understood where he was coming from and how, you know, how he felt like he had to act to combat that fear. Like, I got it. Like, I understood it. I didn't think that was the best tool for me. I carried a gun as a teenager too, But, you know, I would, like, I never you know, used it against another person. Might have flashed it a couple times, but to get myself out of a sticky situation. But guns has never been my thing. And some people are shooters and some people aren't. I'm not. I don't fake, you know, I never fake that life. I never try to pretend to be about that life. I was never into it, but it's kind of, when I was growing up in that crack era, it's something that you needed it.
How did you get your first gun? You write in your book, The Beast Side, that in your neighborhood it was easier to get a gun than to get a job. So how did you get yours?
So I bought my first gun from some dudes in a neighborhood that sold guns. It was simple, and I bought it for exactly that reason that we just talked about, to bluff my way out of situations. Half the time, the guns I had wasn't really loaded, and even when I went to the cast to get it, you know, it's crazy because it wasn't like a shock. Like, it wasn't like, hey, what you want a gun for? It wasn't like that. It was more like, yo, what you need? Mm-hmm. Like, business as usual, and it's still like that. You know, the gun dealers change, and you know, the kid, it's different sets of kids coming up, some passing away, some going to jail, but the gun culture is the same. It's really, really, really easy to get a gun, and it's, you know, and it's sad.
So you've mentioned the crack epidemic. What impact did the crack epidemic have on your family and friends? Did you know a lot of people who were addicted to crack?
It trashed my neighborhood. Everyone was looking for an escape. I'm old enough to remember, you know, before crack really hit. And once it did hit, it changed the whole dynamic of how drug culture worked. You know, back when it was just cocaine, like powder cocaine and heroin, there was like a couple of dudes, older guys, that used to run like whole regions. So, you know, they would control 4 or 5 zip codes. And you would have to buy from them, and then you would make your little money, and it was more of a peaceful type of situation. But when crack came, any and everybody had the opportunity to be a boss, a kingpin. There were like 15 and 16-year-old kids on every corner making like $10,000 plus a week. It was a brand new crew on every corner. And then when the crew on one corner felt like another crew was doing better, that's when gunplay started. So it changed everything, because almost, you know, my friends and I, we joke about this sometimes, but it's like we almost, you know, don't know people who even, we couldn't, it was hard pressed to find somebody who didn't have a father on drugs, a mother on drugs, both, or at least a father and mother who were strung out for a while before getting themselves together. Everybody's parents were junkies, and all the kids were selling or using, and it was like a super escape. So it was an escape for the person that was, you know, putting it into their body. And then it was an escape for a person who was selling it and making money off of it. And it's just, you know, we don't talk about this, but we still recovering from the crack epidemic now, because it's not as crazy as it was, but we're still feeling like some of the effects of that.
What about in your family?
Yeah, my dad used for a long time, and then he got clean. And unfortunately, my brother lost his life. You know, he was out there. He was making money. He was one of those guys who, the popular guy with a nice car and pretty girlfriend and all that. And you know, he got gunned down over an unfortunate situation.
He was selling crack or other drugs?
Yeah, crack.
How old was he when he started dealing, and how old were you at that time?
So he started really clicking around the time I was about 10. And he was 15.
What did it look like from your 10-year-old perspective to see him?
Normal, because all the kids were doing it.
Mm-hmm, but
it looked normal.
And you started making a lot of money. How did that look to you?
As a kid, it was cool because, you know, I had a dirt bike and a street bike and, you know, some cool clothes and things like that. So
from my,
yeah, so from my perspective, it looked cool.
Did he?
It looked cool, but he never ever wanted me to sell drugs, and never like tried to push that lifestyle on me. He used to tell me stuff like, you know, if I sell drugs, I have the opportunity to not sell drugs. If I sold drugs, I would be a clown. If I sold drugs, I would be a follower. Like, I don't really have to be out there. And, you know, he has a plan that he's working on, but, you know, he's not really ready to talk about that. But I don't need to do it. I need to go to school and try to figure out how to be a good student and things like that. He said that both of us didn't need to be doing that, more or less. That's on him. And at first I wasn't really with it because I wanted to be like him. You know, I was known as Bip or Dev, little brother. That's who I was known as. That's what they called me. Like, I was in his shadow, and I liked it, you know, because everyone liked him. So a lot of people liked me, so I wanted to be like him. And I used to try to come outside and participate in the drug talk, and his friends, they would laugh me off. Or I used to tell them that, you know, I can do stuff too, and, you know, I can work and all that. And they used to, you know, I didn't really understand. But as I got older and some of my friends started selling drugs, I got it. And it was the worst job in the world. It was like nothing that I wanted to do. Them dudes weren't bosses and they weren't kingpins. They were the guys putting in them long days. Sometimes some dudes that work like 15-hour days outside all day trying to sell a certain amount of vials, you know, before they can chill. And I was more into playing basketball and riding my dirt bike and hanging out. And, you know, I was like, yo, I never, ever, ever want to sell drugs in my life, like, at all.
So at the time when you were 10 and your brother was 15 and he started making money selling drugs and trying to prevent you from doing the same, is that when you were living together?
Yeah. Actually, no. We were living with my mom, and we actually didn't leave out until I turned 12.
When he had enough money to
get his own spot and to build his own thing and do his own life.
So did the fact that he had money and was getting the money from selling drugs, did that make you feel any more safe or any more vulnerable?
It became normal. He wasn't the guy. He wasn't the conflict guy. He wasn't the guy that was going to be out there shooting at people and you know, starting trouble and trying to, you know, bang and take territory and things like that. From what I know, you know, I don't know the inner workings of his business, but from what I know, he wasn't that guy. Even to this day, he has a reputation of being like a cool guy, somebody that everybody liked and had love for. And, you know, that coolness, you know, the game is a monster, and that coolness didn't work. It couldn't save anybody. Nobody's really safe. But through those years, I never felt like I was in danger.
Your brother was shot and killed. What's your understanding of what happened?
I don't really know. There's a couple stories out there. I don't know the full story. There was some rumors that it was over a girl, and some kids went to war with this other guy because of that. And then it was some rumors about somebody wanted that block he had. So there's a bunch of rumors floating around, but there's no direct like link to what happened, and no one has been arrested for that crime. I don't like to speak on things unless I really know what happened.
Right.
So I try to, like, you know, I try to be fair to myself and to that situation. Like, I have my own little theories, but again, they're my theories, you know. But there's a lot of stories floating around. Most of them revolving around money.
Dee Watkins speaking to Terry Gross last year. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2015 interview with Dee Watkins. He's just written a new book, The Cook-Up, a memoir about his days growing up and dealing drugs in Baltimore.
So we were talking about how your brother was shot and killed when you were 17. You'd been living with him since you were 12. He'd been dealing drugs since you were 10, crack. And so you realized you had to get your own place. You were graduating from high school. You ended up going to college. You write in your book that your SAT scores were good enough so that they looked really impressive from somebody coming from your neighborhood, but you had a feeling if you weren't from, like, the ghetto that they wouldn't have seemed that impressive. But you got into Loyola, and how did your brother's death, how did your brother being shot to death, how did that affect your thoughts about going to college and the level of importance of that in your life?
So I got into a bunch of different schools. I had some skills, and I had some people in my high school that worked with me and helped me develop when I really needed to get into college. And I wasn't going to go. I actually stayed home that first semester. And my friends, the support from my family and friends, they just pushed me to go. And I didn't really know what I was doing. Like, I didn't have a plan. I just thought that. And from when I grew up, I was taught that it doesn't really matter what you go to college for. As long as you go, you'll be able to get a job and make a decent amount of money and be able to live, like, a good life with a quality wage. So I didn't go in there with a plan. And then it was culture shock. You know, I was coming out of East Baltimore, the type of neighborhood where I lived in. Baltimore City is very segregated, so my whole neighborhood was black. Everyone I played basketball with was black. If the people who used to go to church and all that, they were all black churches. The only white people that you would actually come across is like housing police or a teacher or something like that. But for the most part, everybody else is a black person. So I was encouraged to not go to a HBCU. Some of my teachers and some of the people who I knew who was kind of like helping me out through this whole process were saying that you should go to a PWI because America doesn't look like a HBCU, even though your neighborhood.
Okay, wait. HBCU is a historically black university. Yeah. What's the other acronym you use?
Predominantly White Institute.
Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah. I hadn't heard PWI before. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So I was told that, you know, the world is diverse and you need to go to a place where you can interact with different types of people and things like that. And when I got there, it was culture shock. It was like my first time meeting, like, you know, what we would call like a frat boy. It was my first time meeting elite people who came from not the type of money I was coming from, but for real money. And it was my first time meeting black people who look down on other types of black. I didn't even know a black elite existed at this time. I thought, if I see a black person, and I was like, hey, what's up, man? And, you know, they would look back, I'm not your man. And I was like, whoa. And after a couple of months of being there, maybe like a month and a half, you know, I met a couple of people, but it didn't really work. And I dropped out. And I just felt more at home in the street and around street people. So that's what I decided to go ahead and live out what I felt like my destiny was.
Which was selling drugs.
Yeah, because I felt like I've been around drug dealers my whole life. Not just from my dad hustling and my brother being out there, like, really, you know, making money, working at it. But I had, like, I was trained. I already knew. Like, I knew how to deal with police officers. I knew how to deal with people who snitched. I knew how to deal with, like, war and turf and territory. I have a luxury of stories that I just absorbed from the block. Like, it was almost like, it was like a fish in water.
So when you decided that this was your destiny, this is what you were trained for, this is how you were going to make your money, and you started to sell drugs, what were you selling?
Cocaine and crack. A little bit of heroin. I had a little bit of heroin, like, but I didn't bust it down and try to sell it off. I middlemaned some deals for some people and sold off what little I had left over.
How did you get started?
So when my brother passed, he left some. He had a safe, and he actually left some. Some money and some drugs.
Oh.
So it was almost like a starter kit. It's like my hood, my ghetto trust fund.
Right.
He left some, and I discovered it, but I didn't know what to do with it first because I was like, yo, do I really want to do this? Do I want to trash it? Do I want to take the money and you know, start a company. But it's like, yo, what kind of company am I going to start? Like, I'm 18. Like, I don't, you know, I don't have a skill. You know, I'm not really sure. And then I was like, you know what? I'm not doing the college thing. I'm not doing that. You know, I'm not, I don't really know where my place is, but I feel like I have this stuff for a reason. So I'm just going to go all the way with it. And, you know, my friends are already doing it and they could use the help. And I can just do this for a while until I make a bunch of money and figure out what I want to do. Maybe get out the city. And, you know, I don't really know. I didn't have a plan, but I felt like I wasn't going to be that guy that was working 18 hours a day that I saw when I was a kid. And I wasn't going to be that guy going to war with a bunch of other people. But I was going to, you know, I was just going to make a bunch of money.
Dee Watkins speaking to Terry Gross last year. His new book about growing up and dealing drugs on the streets of Baltimore is called The Cook-Up, a crack rock memoir. We'll continue their conversation after a quick break. And we'll also have film critic David Edelstein's review of the new movie Love and Friendship and an appreciation of poet Michael Harper, who died last week at age 78. I'm David Bean Cooley, and this is Fresh Air.
The Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Avalara, tax automation for businesses of all sizes. Avalara works to simplify sales tax and other business taxes with real-time rates and automatic filing at avalara.com, AVALARA.com. And from AT&T, with a network and solutions for helping companies sense and adapt to meet the demands of business. Discover the power of and with AT&T.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, in for Terry Gross, back with more of Terry's 2015 interview with writer Dee Watkins. He has a collection of personal essays called The Beast Side, Living and Dying While Black in America, and a new memoir called The Cook-Up. Watkins has master's degrees in education and creative writing and now teaches at the University of Baltimore. He describes himself as having beat the streets. He grew up in East Baltimore during the crack epidemic. His brother became a dealer and was shot to death. Watkins went to college shortly after, but soon dropped out and started selling drugs himself, mostly crack and cocaine. After his brother was killed, Watkins discovered a stash of drugs and cash his brother left behind. He called it his starter kit to get into dealing.
So you had the starter kit, you found the starter kit, so to speak, in your brother's safe. Where was the safe? Because you had already moved out of...
No, we moved. When we moved the safe.
Got it. Okay.
The safe is huge. It's like more heavy than huge. It's like a 200-pound safe. It took like a couple people to move that joint. Like, and I knew when he passed, I knew it was something in there because, like, I just remember him throwing stuff in there. And I remember, like, at his time, at his, you know, times when he had real big runs before he had to dump his money off in different places. We used to have to, like, lay on our, you know, I had to lay on my back with him. I got that from him, laying on my back to kick that safe closed, like, because it was so jammed up with, like, you know, street money's not like the money you get from the bank. You know, street money is like, you know, $10,000 might look like $150,000, you know, because it's so bulky and used and fluffy and, you know, it looks like
small,
a lot.
Small bills.
Yeah, small bills. So, you know, I knew, like, even from when I first day I went to college, like, I knew it was something in that safe. I just had to be ready for what was in there. That's why I wasn't really worried about money. I wasn't really worried about, you know, like, what I was going to do, you know, because I already had some money put up from that I got from him when you know, that I was getting from him anyway. Like, you know, he would leave, you know, he would, yo, here's a couple dollars, whatever. Like, I already had a little bit of money stacked up. So I wasn't really worried about cash. I was more or less worried about what I was going to do. And once I decided to do that, I said, you know what, I'm going to be the best at it.
You'd seen crack really ruin the lives of people. You know, your father used crack. You said most of your friends had a parent who was on crack. And how did you feel about knowing you were selling something that destroyed people?
I used to have these thoughts to myself about how this is what these people want. I'm not putting a gun to their head. I wasn't out there making them do it. Yeah, I saw the effects. And those effects, like, they hit me in different ways, but I just felt like we were all just part of this whole big piece of nothingness. And I had to pick my role. I knew I wasn't going to be a person using it.
How did you know you weren't going to be a person using it?
Because I just, the crackhead coming up was like the bottom of the barrel in our community. Like, you know, the crackhead was the person who stole video games. The crackhead was the person who everybody used to laugh at. The crackhead was a person with no teeth. The crackhead was always the butt of everybody's joke, and I never wanted to be that. It was the most embarrassing role you can play in a community, to the point where, you know, the same way how a lot of society looks at me and doesn't really see me as a human, it's the kind of the same way, you know, we shifted that energy onto them. You see how that works? Mm-hmm. It's like the hierarchy. And that was never gonna be me. So, you know, I justified it by telling myself that if I'm here or not, these people are gonna be using it anyway. And I felt like I hit this epiphany. I felt like this is what I was here to do. I thought this was my purpose, my mission in life, and, you know, my limited exposure and the opportunities I had, like, all pointed in this direction. So I dove into it. Like, I didn't have a plan on an exit strategy. I just had a plan on doing it until I, you know, and just see whatever was going to happen was going to happen.
Okay, so you were good at selling crack. You sold it out of the neighborhood, so the people in your neighborhood were no longer your competition. You were making money. Why did you stop?
A ton of reasons. Most of the reasons revolve around my friends and the situations that they were in. They were being locked up. Some of them were indicted, and they weren't getting, like, some of them were nonviolent crimes, and they weren't getting, like, 3 years and all that. They was getting, like, 20 years and stuff like that. I had one of my best friends, 27 years for nonviolent crime. So that was one. Two, my sets of friends were changing. You know, I was the last guy left. It's a lot of the dudes who I did business with, they wasn't going to jail, they was dying. And it's just that whole idea of always being alone and knowing that selling drugs is not a team game. You don't link up with some childhood friends and build an empire. That's television and the movies. Selling drugs is one-on-one. You're always going to be alone. Like, you know, because at the end of the day, the business it trumps all of these relationships, and it happens over and over again. There's so many stories about this guy setting up his friend, or this guy losing a friend, or this guy stealing from his friend and so forth. And I went from being not really caring if I lived or died to caring. And I knew if I wanted to live, I had to stop.
So how did you decide that you're definitely stopping selling drugs and you wanted to go back to college?
I didn't want to sell drugs anymore. I bought a liquor store. You know, people tell these stories, oh, once you went too deep, you can't come out, or the gangsters will come and kill you. No. If you don't re-up, they won't sell it to you. Somebody else will be there to take that place. And the game, it doesn't stop. The game never stops. It never stops. You know, the players change, but it doesn't stop. So I thought that if I can sell drugs, I can sell cocktails and cold beer, you know. So I bought a liquor store. I put this bar called Stadium Hideaway. It was a cool little place. It was it had a little carry out in the front, and you get buzzed into the back, and it was a lounge. And you know, I did like fish fries on Fridays, and you know, ran a little business, and I did that for a while, and still, you know, the same pain and the same hurt and some of the same feelings I felt being the person who operated as an illegal drug dealer. I felt the same thing as an illegal drug dealer. It was the same thing. We had poker machines. People dumped all their money in the poker machines. People came in and they drunk like crazy, and it was just like, it was almost like the same thing, like escape, escape, escape. So I got rid of that. I sold that, and you know, I stacked the money up, and I opened up a little tag and title shop, and I enrolled in the university in Baltimore, and I went to school for history, and it was there where I started to play with the idea of becoming a writer.
Did you ever wish that you could put successful drug dealer on your resume because you thought you were really good at it, you made a lot of money at it, and even though it's illegal, it was a sign that you could hold your own in a business, an illegal business, an addictive business, but nevertheless, did you wish that you could say, hey, I was good at this?
I mean, it is on my resume, kind of, because it makes it into everything else I do. As a student, I didn't think the way the average student would think. As a writer, I'm not thinking. I don't think the way that a lot of writers think when I'm writing out proposals and business plans. Everything's strategic. Everything has a point. You know, so I think it makes it into my life in different ways. I'm not proud of that being my origin, but I understand that if I didn't go through that, I wouldn't be able to do the work that I do right now. So it kind of still... It gives me, like, it's on my resume when I speak to young people and I tell them, like, yo, I made these mistakes. I was in the street. I've done these things. And I'm here to tell you that it's an illusion. Like, it's all a facade. It's nothing glamorous about being a drug dealer. And nothing can ever come from it but hurt and pain. And you don't need to ever even think about trying it.
You write in your book, before I became a reader, I had no problem cracking a Hennessy bottle across the back of some guy's head.
That line sounds cooler when you read it.
it sounds a little different than what you're saying, because everything that you've described so far is more about not being, seeing the violence, but not really being active in being violent yourself, but...
Yeah, I'm not an angel, but, you know, and basically what I write that line, and that's, you know, from a situation that happened, it goes back to the failure to communicate. So I had gotten all type. I didn't duck violence. Let me be clear on that. I don't identify as a violent person. I'm not a bully, and I don't look for trouble, but, you know, I definitely don't turn it down. And a lot of them situations came from my inability to communicate. I got into some situations, even in college, with some other students. They didn't end up being super violent, but they got kind of nasty because of that communication barrier. So reading, becoming a reader, opened up a lot of those things for me. Not just my interactions with people outside of my community, but the more I read, the more I had a better understanding of people.
So you graduated, and you not only graduated from Baltimore University, you went to Johns Hopkins University and got your master's in education, and then you went back to Baltimore University and got an MFA, a Master of Fine Arts in Creative Writing. So you spent a lot of time in college.
Yeah, college was the safest place in the world for me. It was, you know, despite all the, you know, the weirdo stuff that comes along with it, it was a place where I was being challenged to think and learn and complete task and think and learn and complete task and be exposed over and over and over again every semester. It became a place where I can just hide and get a lot of things that I didn't get coming up.
Well, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
And good luck with your writing and your teaching.
Thank you. Thanks.
Dee Watkins speaking to Terry Gross in 2015. His new book about growing up and selling drugs in Baltimore is called The Cook-Up, a crack rock memoir. Coming up, film critic David Edelstein reviews the new Love and Friendship movie, and we remember poet Michael Harper. This is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Subaru, automotive partner of the National Park Service Centennial. Subaru encourages people to explore America's treasures and discover a national park adventure at findyourpark.com. Love, it's what makes a Subaru. And from the financial services firm of Raymond James, offering personalized wealth management advice and banking and capital markets expertise, all with a commitment to putting clients' financial well-being first. Learn more at raymondjames.com.
This is Fresh Air. Love and Friendship is director Whit Stillman's dramatization of the early Jane Austen novella Lady Susan. The novella probably was written by Austen in the mid-1790s, but wasn't published until 1871, long after the author's death. Kate Beckinsale plays the story's unscrupulous protagonist, Lady Susan Vernon. Film critic David Edelstein has this review.
The writer-director Whit Stillman's Love and Friendship is an improvement on its source, Jane Austen's novella Lady Susan. That's not quite as heretical as it sounds. Austen wrote the book early in her career, before Pride and Prejudice. It wasn't published in her lifetime. The title isn't even hers. It didn't have one. It's an epistolary work, told via letters, and as such, missing Austen's all-important voice as narrator. Her protagonist, Lady Susan Vernon, is an impoverished widow with designs on a married lord and a malign indifference to her own teenage daughter. She seems a pale copy of the villainess of another epistolary novel that was widely read at the time, Les Liaisons Dangereuses. Early in Love and Friendship, you realize that Stillman doesn't hate Lady Susan nearly as much as Austen seems to. The woman's will must be thwarted, of course, for the sake of her spirited daughter. But as played by Kate Beckinsale, she cuts an impressive figure. She's attractive, she's indefatigable, and she's poetically eloquent in justifying her immorality. We meet her after she's left the estate of one Lord Manwaring, after enchanting the host and driving the hostess, Lady Manwaring, to despair. The next place she decides to stay, that's how she lives, you see, off wealthy friends and relations, is the mansion of her late husband's brother. She charms him, but unnerves his wife, Lady Catherine de Courcy Vernon, an unusually empathetic woman played by the delightful Emma Greenwell. Just as alarming to Lady Catherine is the behavior of her younger brother, Reginald de Courcy, played by Xavier Samuel with a bit of Hugh Grant's adorable lockjaw. Reginald claims to want to study Lady Susan's wiles from an anthropological perspective, but he seems more and more seduced by them. You might be thinking, that's a lot of names to keep track of, and I've cited only a few. Stillman helps by presenting the characters, one or two at a time, with accompanying title cards and descriptions. It's still hard to keep the relationship straight, but the device bespeaks an affection for the milieu that makes you want to use words like bespeaks. Love and Friendship has both formal elegance and theatrical glee, so it might have seemed stuffy and posed, now sings with undercurrents. The catalyst is Lady Susan's teenage daughter, Frederica, who's run away from her expensive boarding school and who's trailed to the Vernon estate by a boobish suitor named Sir James Martin. Sir James is pomp and gloriously played by Tom Bennett, who reminded me of Peter Cook as one of his impervious-to-reality titled Englishmen. But Lady Susan insists that Frederica acquiesce to this idiot's affections.
I'm sorry. Have I done anything that's dishonored you or father?
To honor means, among other things, to listen with respect to a parent's sincere counsel.
I do listen with respect, Mama. It's just that...
If you will not pay attention to me, then perhaps you will to a larger imperative. The law of the universe. An offer as splendid as Sir James's is not likely to come around again. He has offered you the one thing he has of value to give. His income. I fear and reproach myself, having shielded you for far too long. Had I let you starve a little bit more, you would resist much less.
Mama, I was often hungry at school.
Oh, evidently not hungry enough. In any case, the starvation of the schoolhouse is nothing like that of the destitute. Is that what you want?
No. I can see Sir James is a kind man, and if it weren't a matter of marriage, I'm sure I could like him. But marriage is for one's whole life.
Not in my experience.
Kate Beckinsale's attack is driving and precise, her diction so sharp it can draw blood. And Whit Stillman has given her amazing lines, some, but not all, culled from the novella's letters. They come at you so fast that the movie's texture is positively Oscar Wildean. Or perhaps I should say, the movie reminds you how much Wilde owed to Austen. In one scene, Lady Susan declares of her daughter's private school, "The fees are too high to even think of paying, so in a sense it's an economy." Later, she dubs America a nation of ingrates, adding, "Only having children makes you understand such behavior." Her poor daughter, played by the winsome Morfydd Clark, wouldn't stand a chance without the benign intervention of, well, Thereby Hangs the Tale, which builds to a near farcical pitch. The cast has one weak link, Chloe Sevigny, who's forced to speak too quickly as Lady Susan's American confidant. The performance, though, makes you realize why Sevigny is so wonderful in other roles. Her dreamy rhythms are uniquely her own. And I don't care for Stillman's dullish title, Love and Friendship. I even prefer the one suggested with tongue-in-cheek by author Leo Rockus, who adapted Lady Susan into a novel, Flirtation and Forbearance, or Coquetry and Caution. But by any title, the movie is an absolute treat.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. Coming up, we remember poet Michael Harper, who died last week at age 78. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. We'll end this week by remembering the poet Michael Harper, who died Saturday at age 78. He was known for his poems that were influenced by and celebrated jazz, starting with his first volume of poetry, Dear John, Dear Coltrane, which was nominated for a National Book Award. Many of his poems were about important figures in African-American history, such as Jackie Robinson, Richard Wright, and the abolitionist John Brown. Terry Gross interviewed Harper and poet Sonia Sanchez in 2000 about a CD anthology of black poets reading their own work. Terry asked Michael Harper to read his poem, Dear John, Dear Coltrane.
Dear John, Dear Coltrane. A love supreme, a love supreme, a love supreme, a love supreme. Sex, fingers, toes, in the marketplace near your father's church in Hamlet, North Carolina. Witness to this love in this calm fallow of these minds. There is no substitute for pain. Genitals gone or going. Seed burned out. You tuck the roots in the earth, turn back and move by river through the swamps, singing, a love supreme, a love supreme. What does it all mean? Loss, so great each black woman expects your failure in mute change. The seed gone. You plod up into the electric city, your song now crystal and the blues. You pick up the horn with some will and blow into the freezing night. A love supreme, a love supreme. Dawn comes and you cook up the thick sin between impotence and death. Fuel the tenor sax cannibal heart, genitals and sweat that makes you clean. A love supreme, a love supreme. Why you so black? Cause I am. Why you so funky? Cause I am. Why you so black? Cause I am. Why you so sweet? Cause I am. Why you so black? Cause I am. A love supreme, a love supreme. So sick you couldn't play Naima. So flat we ached for song you'd concealed with your own blood. Your diseased liver gave out its purity. The inflated heart pumps out the tenor kiss, tenor love. A love supreme, a love supreme. A love supreme, a love supreme.
That's Michael Harper reading his poem, Dear John, Dear Coltrane. Were you listening to, obviously you must have been listening to a lot of Coltrane while writing this. Had you seen him perform shortly before writing this?
Well, I began to watch Coltrane play live in about 1955. And I wrote the poem actually before Coltrane died. Coltrane died in 1967. I wrote the poem in 1966. And I was terrified because, you know, as poets, you sometimes have material select you. And I, of course, knew his music and listened to him live many times. I'd written about his great drummer, Elvin Jones, and McCoy Tyner was a friend of mine. He was the same age and pretty much grew up together. But Coltrane was a special figure, and he was not a terribly talkative man. And I had spent many, many times being in his company. But when I wrote this poem, I was terrified that I was, writing his death warrant or something. And the reason why the refrain, A Love Supreme, is because he himself had played that in 1964. And he and his musicians had chanted that. And it was a refrain, a kind of anthem, which became widespread among the black community, the musical community. And Coltrane was the superior musician of his generation.
Michael Harper, do you feel that you have learned about language and its rhythms from reading with musicians, as you've occasionally done?
Absolutely. And the most important thing you learn from musicians is phrasing. And you learn it from the singers, the Bessie Smiths, the Billie Holidays, the Mamie Smiths, the Aretha Franklins even. But you also learn more than anything else about the authenticity of phrasing, because musicians take you to places that you might not necessarily want to go, and they go instantly to the transcendent. And of course, the mastery of their playing is not technical mastery. It is spiritual mastery. It is to take you to a place that perhaps is not your mode. And when we are in performance with musicians, they take us to places sometimes we don't want to go. We're not prepared to go. They take us instantly there. And it seems to me that the pioneering efforts of great musicians, and Coltrane is just one of many, gives us a way, indicates the path. And of course, they're on the frontier, which is one of the reasons why we lose so many, because they're forced to live at the cutting edge of the society. And oftentimes, that's sacrifice to themselves. And I'm not only talking about drugs. I'm talking about the rigor with which they have to express themselves, bring themselves. And of course, the pressure that black people in particular are under and always have been. The musicians they're the frontier. They're on the frontier, and we have to learn how to follow.
That was poet Michael Harper, recorded in 2000. He died last Saturday at the age of 78. On Monday's show, how genetics is profoundly changing our definition of disease and the way we treat disease, we talk with oncologist Siddhartha Mukherjee about his new book, The Gene. Mukherjee also is the author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book about the history of cancer, The Emperor of All Maladies. Hope you can join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our associate producer for online media is Molly C.B. Nesper. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancool.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the law firm Cooley LLP. With offices in the U.S., Europe, and China, Cooley advises entrepreneurs, investors, financial institutions, and established companies around the world, where innovation meets the law. And from the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide to address inequality in all its forms. Learn more at fordfoundation.org.